Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Learning Pod Network, brought to you by Impact Connections, where we'll be taking a deep dive into the new world of learning pods that are driving educational innovation around the world. I'm your host, Steve Eno. The world has been changed forever by COVID-19. Right now, families and schools around the country are trying to figure out the best way forward without much support. That is why we have created the Impact Connections Learning Pod Network. We believe small group learning, driven by family needs and supported through a network of strong relationships, can improve education for everyone in this moment and beyond. On this podcast, we'll bring you advice from innovative educators and experts to help you create the best learning experience possible. To stay up to date with our latest tools and offerings, please check out our website at www.impactconnections.org. Hi, everyone. On today's episode, we have a very special guest, Dr. Alex Lees. I was connected to Alex through an old friend of mine, Zach Diono. I was initially hoping to interview Zach about his experience in Teach for America and being a part of the founding team of a charter school in Hawaii. But Zach told me that Alex would be a much better interview. I know that Zach would have been great to talk to, and hopefully we can still have him on the podcast in the future. But Alex is absolutely amazing. Getting to hear Alex's story of launching a new charter school, Dream House, Eva Beach, is truly inspirational. We rarely get to hear about the trials and tribulations that school founders go through, and Alex's story shows just how dedicated and passionate educators are when they try to create a better learning experience for students in their community. On top of that, Alex gives us insights into the internal struggles he went through in being a haole, or non-Hawaiian native, founder, and how he found a way to bridge cultural gaps and build partnerships. Alex's positive mindset is something we all need more of these days. I was truly inspired by Alex, and I know you will get a lot out of our conversation. Enjoy. Welcome to the podcast, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us from Hawaii in an early morning at the beginning of this school year. To start us off, I'd love to just get some background. We were introduced through a mutual friend, Zach Diono, and I'd love to hear about your experience working with Zach, how you met, and I think that also introduces a little bit to your education background as well.
For sure. So again, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, Steve. So Zach and I met 2008 through Teach for America. We both did Teach for America here in Hawaii. He was actually a year ahead of me in the program. So he had had a year under his belt. And I came out in June 2008 and met him. And we were placed at the same school. So we immediately had a connection because of both being from the East Coast, both played sports in college. Really hit it off. So I looked to him as a bit of a mentor and a friend, as someone who had a year on me in Teach for America. And then also just started spending some time together outside of school and getting to know one another better. So that was really the foundation for the work that we would come to do together. But it was a friendship. It was a mutual, understanding and connection through the East Coast, and then just working through education at the school we were placed at here for Teach for America. So, coming to Hawaii, I'm obviously, like I said, from Massachusetts. I had never been to Hawaii before. And in 2008, I came to Hawaii for the first time through Teach for America, through the Teach for America program. And I was teaching seventh grade English in the community of Eva Beach, which ironically would be the same exact community that years later, 11 years later, actually, total, we opened in 2019. So 11 years after I got here for the first time, we opened Dream House Eva Beach Public Charter School. So it's been an incredible journey, and I know that we'll dig into it, but that's a little bit of the background and what brought me here to Hawaii and when it was and how Zach and I know each other.
Awesome. Thank you for that quick background. And yeah, we'll definitely dig into different aspects of that. But yeah, I'd love to kind of give a little bit of background on Dreamhouse and what it is. I know you're in your second year now, and obviously the whole education world is changing with COVID, but I'd love to hear a little bit about Dreamhouse, how it got started, and what makes it special.
Sure. So Dreamhouse Eva Beach Public Charter School for long, and then Dreamhouse for short, is a school that was founded really starting in 2012. A group of Teach for America alumni, community leaders, educators, parents all got together and just asked the question, what if we started our own school? What would it be about? What impact would it make in the community? And what we landed on was, that we needed to do a little bit of learning and digging and soul searching ourselves. So we, in 2013, a bunch of us took a trip to the Bay Area and saw some high performing schools just to immerse ourselves in the charter world a little bit because we weren't too familiar. There's charter schools in here in Hawaii, but we hadn't started one. We hadn't been a part of launching one. So it was all very new to us. So in 2013 to 2014 and 15, we did what was called a learning tour. And for 2 years, every weekend, all the neighborhood boards, nights, and we would just sit down and have coffee and talk story about education and about public education and school out into the future and what it could be and how we would build one. And at the end of that, we said, okay, well, I think we're ready to at least open up a Google search and ask, what is a charter school? So, that really, I always bring people back to those moments because before we knew how to do it, we knew why we wanted to do it. And it was really a connection of the heart and what we were passionate about. And then we had to figure out what to build it. We didn't build it and then say, okay, now what are we going to be about? What is our ethos going to be? What is our vision, our values, our core beliefs, our all of those things that really come to define us now were before we even knew how to build a charter school. So that was way back, 2012, 13, 14, 15. I actually went away to grad school for a year, and that is where that's the time that we wrote our first application. And we wrote the application for Dreamhouse 2015 to 16, submitted it to the state of Hawaii, and got denied. And that was really a hard time for us because after spending 4 years as a team building out the framework for what we thought was going to be our public charter school that would launch a year later, we were just stopped at the entry gate, right? We couldn't even get across the starting line. And so we went back to the drawing board. We took a year off, or I guess took a year on, really, working to build out this application in a little bit better way to go back to the state of Hawaii. We went back to the state of Hawaii 2017, submitted our application. And again, they said, no, this is not going to work. You see, but that doesn't make sense. We corrected all your edits, right? And they said, well, it's not going to work unless here are the two conditions. You've got to find a facility and you've got to raise some money. So we went out and raised $100,000 in like a month. We had all these lineups for facilities, but we couldn't end up finding a facility. So they said, well, you have to delay a year. So now we're into 2018. And again, I go back to 2012 when we just asked the question, what would it take to start a school? Now we're in 2018. We've got half of a charter approved. We got a little money in the bank. We can't find a space to open our school. And finally, in December 2018, a local developer and landowner here said, we'll give you 3,400 square feet of empty office space above a Buffalo Wild Wings in the corner of a shopping plaza. And you can do whatever you need to do there for a year. And then you got to find your own place. So that's where we started our school last year, in 3,400 square feet of empty office space. It was a wild ride. And all the while, we had also entered into a lease for this space, which is where we are now in a small community called Kalaeloa, which is just south of Kapolei. And this is our home. This is our dream house. So this is the place that we moved into. And we've got a 10-year lease, and we're working alongside of the developer and some other partners to build out a longer-term vision to be able to grow, because we're just a sixth and seventh grade this year. And eventually, we want to grow 1 year at a time to be a 6 through 12, 700 kids middle and high school. So that is the long and short of the last 8 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. And again, I think it's so great to be able to read through your dissertation and be able to hear that story
Oh,
because,
you read that? I'm sorry.
yeah. No, I think it's awesome because so many people don't really understand what it takes to start a school. I mean, we're so, I guess, lucky in most parts of the United States to have schools everywhere. And we hear about schools being started, and a lot of educators have approached me and said, let's start a school. It's pretty easy. And then reading through your dissertation, hearing you describe it, it's obviously not as easy as everyone thinks. And so I think having that insight into the challenges and the mindset that it takes to overcome those challenges to create an amazing school like you have is truly awesome. And so thank you for putting that all down in your dissertation and for sharing that with us. And
appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I think it's awesome. And I'm curious, obviously you mentioned some of the challenges in your quick description of starting up the school, but I'm curious what helped you and your team work through those challenges? What drove you to never give up and to keep going despite those many challenges that you faced and those many hurdles that were thrown in your way?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's easier to answer looking back now versus when we were in the throes of it and we didn't know what the outcome was going to be. And not that we're at a resting place or an outcome, but finally we have a building that we can walk into and turn the lights on and hold a Zoom podcast call with some good, reliable internet. So we've at least gotten to a tiny little plateau and we're ramping up to take our next big steps and add our eighth grade and then add a high school and talk to kids about college. So there's a wonderful story still to be written ahead of us. But, you know, I think we just always saw the future of Dreamhouse and saw it happening. We believed in it so much and we knew that it could be possible, that it, in a way we willed it into existence. And it wasn't that we willed it against any one person or, you know, it wasn't like a partisan battle between ourselves and an opposite group. It was really just the system and environment that is created and exists is really hard to break into. Like you said, there are schools. There already are schools. And some people told us that. They said, but we already have schools. Why would you build a new one? Why would you want to build another building and take resources from the existing schools? Why don't you join an existing school and make it better? And I don't know, that just never was our thing. It just never was what we wanted to be a part of. It's kind of like getting an old car and saying, well, why don't you just redo this old car and then that could be your new car. But it's still the old car. We wanted to build something from scratch. And because we were able to build it from scratch, we were able to have our fingerprints on every single part of what we did. That really was the special part that we held on to. And that's what drove us. And in my dissertation, I wrote a little bit about something that I was calling the 11th hour effect. And in the 11th hour is when things would happen. But we had to work from hours 1 to 11 in order for hours 11 to 12, just before the clock struck midnight, to get across whatever finish line it was, whether it was a funding deadline, whether it was getting our building, whether it was hiring people, whether it was recruiting families, whether it was getting our certificate of occupancy, whatever it was, we always seemed to just get over the hump in the final moments. But it was almost because people saw how hard we were working all of the other moments that they said, okay, gosh, these folks have gotten right to the finish line. Let's just nudge them over. And there's other elements that help us actually get across the finish line. But in order to get to that place, 95% done, knowing that we couldn't do the last 5% on our own, we just had to believe. And in the hardest of times, that was what we did. And I just remember people telling me, don't give up, just don't give up. And we didn't. And I'm glad we didn't.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I'd love to get your insights on the current school system.
Sure.
That is in Hawaii, because I think, like you said, when you join onto a school system, you are placed into what is already there. You have these existing constraints, these existing requirements, and you're very limited. I've been teaching for 10 years. I've been in both public and private, and I have done that where I joined onto schools and realized there's only so much that I can do. There's only so much impact I can have on students, because in the end, they're doing everything according to this system that's been in place for decades, if not over a century. And so yeah, I'd love to get your insights on Hawaii. I know Hawaii is a very unique school system, obviously being on an island and having the history that it has. I actually have an uncle that worked at Baldwin High School over on Maui. And so I have some ties to Hawaii with family. So I am aware a little bit about it. But yeah, I'd love to get your perspective on the Hawaii system and why you thought it was so important to, like you said, start from scratch and give students an opportunity to learn in a school like Dreamhouse.
Yeah, good question. A lot of what the research that we did leading into Dreamhouse was looking at what existed, what was working, and then trying to find where the gaps were. By no means are we some silver bullet or the best thing, ever. We're just filling a need that we saw existed. So one of the things about Hawaii is that there are certain school complexes that are completely oversaturated, and there are certain school complexes that there's barely any kids. So if you go to the south side of the Big Island, you've got a K through 12 school and pretty much one building, and they can barely meet their enrollment needs to meet their budget and meet operating for a year. And then down the road from us, we have Campbell High School, that there's 3,000 kids that go there. That's larger than the population of Lanai'i Island. So there's just such discrepancies in terms of where the buildings and where the schools are. So we chose Eva Beach because, one, that's where we had taught, that's where we had connections to the local public schools, the kids, the families. That's really where our heart was in terms of starting a school. But two, we realized that there was such an oversaturation of the schools that existed that we could pose ourselves just as an option for families because the schools were crowded. On the mainland, a lot of the times you have charter schools coming into the community saying, these schools suck, we're going to be better, you got to leave that school. That was not our narrative at all, because our friends still teach at the local public schools. We have kids who are going to come over from the local public schools. We are in partnership with that. While we do things differently, and while we're a little bit, I'd say, more nimble and innovative in our approach to public education, those are still our buddies. So learning about how to be a partner and how to be different while at the same time not negating the impact that other schools are doing and making, it was important. Second thing is that I was thinking about this yesterday. I was having a conversation with someone, but we never at Dreamhouse, we never refer to ourselves as administrators. We always call ourselves coaches. We're leaders. We're school leadership. We're in a very flat system here because a hierarchy that exists in public education removes often top systematic decision makers from the classroom and from kids. So how do you change that? How do you shrink that gap? One, you can see where I'm standing. I'm literally standing right next to a classroom. I can see six of our 11 classrooms from where I was standing, and they can see me. Now, we don't have kids here right now because it's COVID times, but in a regular day where there's 200 kids here, kids are going to be walking around, knocking on the window, waving at me. I'm going to pop out and jump into the class with them. I mean, the proximity of me as the school leader to someone working on a math problem or a STEM project or doing Hawaiian culture is like 6 feet away and through a glass window. So that to me was really important. But in my mind, an administrator administrates a system. They hold the system together. Dreamhouse was created to be outside of the system. You see what I'm saying? So our approach was never to just be an add-on and be a school that was just going to keep the system growing and expanding and maintain how the system operated. But instead, it was to create something new and a new approach to public education. And the opportunity that we had was that schools are just completely oversaturated. There's a ton of kids. Families are looking for different options. They don't have any given the neighborhood schools that they go to. Because if you grow up in Hawaii, specifically in Eva Beach and in the Kapolei area, you go to whatever your elementary school is, your neighborhood. There's one middle school for you, depending on which side of the main road you live on. And then you go to Campbell High School, which is the largest high school in the state. So it's very, I don't want to say it was very easy for us, but it made sense to say, hey, how about we build another option alongside of, but a little bit outside of the traditional system and have it just be another option for families. We did not get the pushback that a lot of people said that we would as starting a new charter. But again, I think that's mainland mentality where people say, oh, charter, you're going to come in, you're going to start talking down on the system. Like, not at all. We're going to do things differently. We're going to move to the beat of a different drum. But that doesn't mean that anyone's right or wrong. We're just going to do things differently. And it's worked out so far.
Yeah, and I love that mindset. I think that's absolutely amazing that you have built those partnerships because I see so many contentious schools in neighborhoods across the country, like you said, because they're claiming they're better than the public school system. And the only way we can move forward is by creating those partnerships. And so that's absolutely amazing that you've been able to do that. And one other thing that you said that really stood out to me and that you wrote about in your dissertation a lot is this idea that you don't call yourself a principal or an administrator.
Yeah. God forbid anyone ever refers to me as a principal.
Right. And you're the chief education officer, which again, I talked about that with my wife. She's like, that's amazing. And I think a lot of people might see that and they may say, oh, well, that's just them trying to bring a business aspect into education. But like you already articulated, it means so much more than just the name or the label. It's about the culture. And so I'd love to talk a little bit more about that culture that you've created, both with the structure, that really flat structure, but also with the little things. Like I looked at the Dreamhouse logo and how much thought and detail went into that. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear about your thoughts about like how you created this culture and why you created this culture in such an intentional way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, it's funny because it's conversations like these, Steve, that make me realize what we're doing. Every day I just get up, I make the coffee, turn the lights on, take the trash out, make sure the internet's working, send a couple emails, hop on a couple phone calls, you know. But when I step back and think about what we're doing, it's fun to talk about it because I'm not talking about this in a daily basis, you know, to my colleagues and my friends who I work with. But yeah, you know, like I said, I really started to drill down on this while I was writing my dissertation. Keep in mind, I was getting my doctorate while we were going through the chartering process. I applied to and got into our doctoral program before we even had the charter approved. So I'm sitting here going, okay, what am I going to write my dissertation on? I can't write my dissertation on the school I started because we haven't even gotten a charter approved. We haven't even raised the money to open. We haven't even hired staff or recruited families or built a curriculum or gotten a building or gotten our certificate of occupancy or opened, or like nothing existed. So to write a dissertation as that was happening was really an immersive experience. And for me, you know, I said it in the first page of my dissertation, I am not a principal. I am not an administrator. That is not who I am. People might refer to me, my role. Oh, you're the principal. Oh, I see what you are. But that's not, you know, if you run the ball and the quarterback hands the ball off to you and someone says, oh, I know who you are. You're a running back. You say, no, I'm a tight end. These are just different plays. I you know, it's like you try to explain to people. And I realized that I found myself trying to explain to people why I wanted to have a different role, why I wanted to be seen as someone different. Just because you carry the ball, it doesn't make you a running back. You know, it was hard for me to settle into, oh, I will be the principal. I will have vice principals. They will have department heads. They will have team leads. They will have teachers. They will have, it just didn't work with me. It didn't feel right. It didn't feel organic. It didn't feel true to what it was that we were trying to do at Dreamhouse. So the role chief education officer is CEO. It is a person who's in an executive role at the school. I am the executive of the school. I work directly with our school board. I work directly with our nonprofit board. I have a leadership team. Our leadership team does administrative duties, but we are the leaders of the school. So I come with a business background, and I really believe that our bottom line, our profit, the most important thing that our school can generate, and we can call it shareholder returns, we can call it equity, we can call it return, whatever we wanna call it, is student outcomes, is the success of our kids. It's not money, it's not retention, it's not whether kids show up, it's not all the other indicators that principals look at on a day-to-day basis and talk about how successful their school is because of all of these indicators. It's whether or not our students are truly successful, lined up to our vision and values. And our vision is empowered homegrown leaders for our island community. So if our kids are leaving us empowered, feeling like they are committed to and connected to and responsible for their community and ready to lead, then our business is, you know, profitable, quote unquote profitable. That's really one of the reasons for the term CEO. My leadership team, chief academic officer, chief financial and chief operations officer, chief student success officer. People say, where's your registrar? Where's your vice principal? Who's your department head? That we don't have. Who does this? Oh, this person does that. But that's not their title, their role, their identity, right? And I think that's part of what we wanted to do too. We want to re-identify so people kind of like they have to catch themselves and try to fit us into this box they've always created. But again, that box that they've always created is for a system that is failing a lot of kids. And it's for a system that's not the system that governs or oversees Dreamhouse. We have our own little mini system here. It's like a small organic farm next to like a big GMO massive operation. That's us. There is a little farm stand on the side of the road with funky titles.
Yeah, and that's a great analogy. I mean, I think hopefully a lot of people recognize that analogy. One thing that you talked about in terms of those success metrics, I am a big fan of data. And again, this may be something that you're still planning out as a school, but I'm just curious, how do you plan on measuring student success? Because I think obviously in the traditional school system, people equate student success with test scores, with grades, with college admissions. And we're kind of realizing, well, maybe that doesn't equate to success because of these scandals like Varsity Blues, and we're realizing the system can be gamed. And so there's all of these ways around these success metrics. And so I was just curious, do you have a vision for how to measure student success outcomes from Dreamhouse?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we do. Again, I'm focused on data and outcomes and output as well. But the things that you just mentioned, there's still components to how we measure success, but they're not as heavily weighted. Like, our kids still need to be able to read, case in point. But the state test that says whether or not they can read is not where we put all our eggs. It's one data point, but it's not where all of our eggs are. There's three main components of Dreamhouse. There's the academic piece, there's a leadership piece, and then there's 21st century skills / social emotional learning piece. And within those three buckets, those three pillars, academics, yes, state test scores, some of our iReady and some of our diagnostic metrics, the different learning cycles and projects we do. So you have, you know, diagnostic and summative assessments here, and the formative assessments we look at as well, and summative assessments. So there's like assessment patterns on an academic side, there's external indicators, and then there's platforms that we use in the school. So through all of those, we get a pretty good sense on an academic standpoint where our kids are. Move over to leadership. Leadership is really self-driven from our kids. So they're assessing themselves a lot, you know, whether it's our parents through student-led conferences, whether it's our coaches through different projects, whether it's peer assessments. A lot of it is rubric-based. A lot of it is growth-oriented. So someone's not going to get a leadership score per se, but they're going to get a rubric-based, you know, assessment of their dispositions. And that a lot of the time will be driven by self. And the social emotional learning piece, it really goes to, again, how our kids are articulating their own growth and development, but also how parents are seeing. A parent is going to know how their 11-year-old is developing, you know, I don't want to say better than the 11-year-old knows, but it's just a different perspective from a parent. So we take a lot of parent surveys and a lot of parent feedback. We hold that up against what other schools are doing so we can kind of see where we are in the overall, you know, the overall pool here. We dig into qualitative data very deeply. We read every comment on surveys. We huddle as a team and talk about individual patterns. We talk about how we can build out small group learning and support. So the success from an SEL 21st century skill point of view is not only, you know, rubric and assessment based that is being driven by our actual kids, but it's really by the feedback and by how people are perceiving, both our kids are perceiving themselves, how our parents are perceiving the growth and the well-being of our kids, and then how we as a school are seeing them. So it's really broken across those three buckets. And it's very emergent. Our evaluation of not only what our kids are up to and how they're doing, and also of our overall program, if it's not working well one week, we'll change it and we'll do something different the next week. And that's how quickly we move. And that has been something that our parents have appreciated the most, is that we don't set it and forget it. We say week to week, we have small learning cycles and we do short cycle interventions so that we can see what is working, how can we get better. We're just very responsive. We can do that with a staff of 19, 200 kids, just two grades, right? It's very hands-on. So those are the ways that we look at success. And maybe you and I will hop on a call a year from now and we'll look at success in a different way. But it's very responsive to really where our kids are now.
Thank you for that. And I love that idea of small learning cycles. And that's a term that I like to throw around as well in terms of these tight feedback loops. And I think a lot of parents probably haven't heard that before. They're used to getting report cards once a semester, maybe twice a semester if they're lucky. And so I'd love to hear just your perspective on, like, what is a tight learning cycle and why are they so important to Dreamhouse?
Yeah, no, good question. There's, I'm trying to think of the, somewhere along the line, you know, a piece of research or an article made an impact on us that has rankings of what works the best in public education versus how much it costs. Some of the lowest cost, highest return metrics, like the top ones, were metacognitive analysis and feedback, peer feedback, coaching, small group learning, like all the things that take a lot of time and are super hands-on and don't necessarily just like end in a multiple choice test that you can hold up an average, but really hands-on things. So we have our kids at the end of each week either do a reflection and share that reflection, and they've got to get, you know, a parent or someone from home to read it. They could do small group sharing, and they work together alongside of their peers and advisories and share out what they learned. So again, they're getting feedback. It's very growth oriented week to week. I don't want to say that we don't have any means of assessment, but it's much more qualitative. It's much more based on a rubric. It's much more based on growth and improving on certain concepts, not on strict diagnostic formative summative assessments. Let's hold the number from the beginning up to the number at the end. We just don't glean enough from that. We want to know about the journey. We want to know about what kids are struggling with. We want to know why. We want to build out supports for different skills and dispositions that they need help with. So our approach to that, it can't be once every 2 months or 2.5 months that we take a snapshot of what someone's learned. We'd rather work on what they don't know in the beginning and have our entire program be built to put them in a position where they're growing and they're learning. And at the end, take a snapshot of what they learned. Now, we might not have captured, again, a number of what they knew at the beginning and number at the end. It might not land as a specific grade per se, but the importance of that is that they are then immersed in a growth-oriented culture of pushing themselves to feel uncomfortable in what they're learning, and for us to see that learning process happen, and again, to work on emergent evaluative ways to get better at, you know, at understanding what their journey is. Morning.
That's amazing, and thank you so much for sharing that. I think there's so much we could learn about the way that kind of you and your team have created Dreamhouse from assessment all the way to partnership. And so you mentioned something in terms of partnering with parents, with the community, with other schools. And you talked about the difference between a mainland mentality and a Hawaiian mentality. And there's something in your dissertation that stuck out when it came to that mainland mentality versus island mentality. And you use this idea of being a Hawley founder. And as a fan of North Shore, that I don't know if you've seen that 80s movie, but Zach and I watched that on the way to football games. And we showed the rest of our football team that movie. And obviously Hawley Turtle calls all of the mainland people Hawleys for the whole movie. And yeah, it's just a great insight into, again, Hawaii has a very rich culture, and the people that are native to Hawaii obviously have insights and traditions that are extremely valuable to them and to their culture. And so I'd love to hear about how you were able to come and, like you said, partner with the community and create Dreamhouse, where it's not some outsider coming in and forcing their will on a community. Instead, it's, hey, we're going to partner together. We're going to build this thing, and we're going to do what's best for the students. And so I'd love to hear how you overcame that, I guess, Hawley mindset, and you were able to really partner with the Hawaiian community.
Yeah, good question. And I did talk about it in my dissertation a lot, because it's an important thread of starting this school and me being the leader and founder of this school. You know, the mindset, I've gotten over the mindset, but the work is every day. And I will always not be from Hawaii, if that makes sense. I'll always be from Western Massachusetts. I'll always have, you know, come here. My family is growing here. You know, my wife's here and she's pregnant. So we're, you know, we're gonna have a child here. We'll begin growing our family here. But looking back, I don't have generations of family members who really made a name for themselves or have an identity that aligns with these islands. That was something that I started on my own. And, you know, I think I was more unsure of this at the beginning of the work and of starting Dreamhouse, because I would listen to the voices that pushed back on the work that I wanted to do and the work that I believed in. And it really wasn't until a couple mentors and a couple people just kind of, you know, took me aside and sat down and said things that resonated with me that I'll never forget, and that really guide my leadership today. And one person told me that, you know, if you work from and live from your heart, people will see past your skin color and the town on your birth certificate. That's not going to matter when people see the work of your heart. And that doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't even happen over the course of a year or two. That's a long, long time that people have to see the work of your heart. And the work of my heart really was coming back year after year when we failed. You know, I left to go to grad school. I came back. We didn't get our charter. We didn't find a building. You know, all of those times, instead of saying, well, I'm going to bail and go to New York or San Francisco, or I'll go work on a charter school in the mainland where I could just, you know, start up shop. I said, we gotta go deeper and deeper and deeper into what's going on, understand the issues, get into the problem, love the problem, and just be so committed to starting the school. It was like, at the end of 8 years of starting school, people were like, oh my goodness, this guy is like, he's either crazy or he's just obsessed or possessed, because he will not give up. Like, this team is going to start this school. And that was what spoke louder than like, oh, he's not from here. He's like, I know everyone, I'm not from here. Okay, let's move on. Right. But there's like, there's this mindset. There's this, I think sometimes there's this stigma that people who are Hawaii put on themselves, and they really allow it to like eat it at them and become part of their identity. That's in a way guiding, you know, what other people see them as, right? So instead of me waking up every morning and say, oh, I'm Haole, and everyone who sees me is gonna see me for that. I'm like, I wake up every morning, I'm like, I'm Alex, I'm gonna go lead from my heart, and people are gonna see me as they choose to see me. And it's taken a while to get there. And I don't wanna say that I always, you know, am good about it. There's always work that I need to do to be better about understanding what my role is as a Haole leader in an indigenous community in the islands of Hawaii. And one of the core, you know, research works that I looked at was from one of my doctoral program professors, and she writes in her work, and I know I cited it a few times in my dissertation, is that for Haole leaders, you know, we have to understand that there's going to be a time for us to step forward, step back, and step out of our work. So my time is to step forward right now. I had to step forward, start this school, build this team, be part of this team. But my work now over the next 5 years will be stepping back and lifting up other leaders, lifting up other people to take much more of a leadership role. And then eventually it's going to be to step out. It can't always be me. And that's something that I live with. And that's something I lead through. So it's a great question. It's something I focus on in my dissertation. It's something that I hope that I get better at and lead through every day.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. And I think that mindset is more important now than ever. And I think there's just so much our whole country could learn from that mindset. And obviously reading through your dissertation, it I think you wrote it a couple of years ago, I want to say. And
I've been writing it for a couple of years, but I turned it in and defended it in April.
Okay.
And then it just got approved last month. So I'm officially Dr. Tease, although I don't know that I'll ever refer to myself as Dr. Tease.
Right. No, well, congratulations.
Cut the line at a Walgreens for a flu shot or something.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's amazing. And congratulations. And I think in reading through it, obviously you couldn't predict all of the social turmoil that our country was going to face this summer and everything that has happened. And I think in reading it, I was just blown away by, like, if we could have leadership sit down and read your dissertation and take this mindset in terms of, again, how to interact across race, across socioeconomic status, Like, there's just so much that I think could be improved upon in terms of our current situation as a country. And so I don't know if you've thought about that at all in terms of what insights you have, like how we could potentially move forward as a country using some of the lessons that you learned during your dissertation. Cause yeah, I was just blown away by that. So yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that in terms of what you think the broader country could do and how we could learn from your experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's also a really big question that I don't fully know the answer to. I think that part of the answer is just living each day in a better way than you have the day before. And I know that sounds really vague, but for each person, that's going to mean a different thing, but you can do it every day. And for me, living, you know, in a way that I feel, you know, I'm responsible for not only my school, but, you know, my growing family, and also the work of, you know, a white male school leader. You know, I worked alongside of our school leadership team this summer, and we created a conversation series around Glenn Singleton's book, Courageous Conversations About Race. And we held a 6-week discussion series about racial equity issues. And this was in the heart of, you know, George Floyd and protests and just kind of the racial reckoning of our country. And it's not that we solved or fixed anything, but we created a space for conversation and for people to enter into that conversation and say, hey, I've got work to do, but I want to be better. And I want to be better tomorrow. I want to take small steps to better understanding where I sit in all this. And that's going back to what I initially said, that I think we just need to make that commitment to want to be better. I think sometimes that we have leadership and people who are a bit more divisive and a bit more polarizing. And it's like, you're either with me or against me. And that happens on both sides of the aisle. That happens on both spectrums. And I want to, you know, point fingers or cast blame. But if we all looked inward and said, hey, I want to get better myself and just take some steps towards better understanding how I can be part of a solution, be part of healing, opening up, space for dialogue, healing, and, you know, working alongside of people, you know, to the left and right of me, no matter what side of the aisle they're on. I think that is the mindset, that if more people had that mindset, I think that we would see a climate in our country that is one of reckoning, that is one of healing, that is one of moving forward together. It's hard, though. I tell you, it's hard to just look forward. It's hard to leave things in the past. And again, I say that, you know, keeping in mind my identity as a white guy from Massachusetts, like, you know, there are times in my life that I just had never had conversations that put me in really difficult positions where I had to come face to face with things that I didn't know or biases that I had or, you know, growth areas that I needed to really put time to work on. And I still have those, but now I can not admit it, but I can talk about it. I can sit in that discomfort. I can commit to wanting to move forward. And again, that disposition, that lean forward, if more people had that, I think we'd be in a little bit of a different place.
Thank you for sharing that. Those are great, great insights. Thank you. I'd love to just shift the discussion a little bit. I know we're running a little short on time, but I'd love to talk about one of the more recent challenges. Obviously, you've talked about everything you've overcame to launch the school. And then now in your second year, COVID hits and you have to obviously transition to virtual. And so how have you handled that? How have you managed that in terms of a young school that now has to deal with the global pandemic as well?
Sure. It's really our people. It's really our coaches, our teachers, our teacher leaders. These folks are just incredible at creating brand new experiences for our kids that are not stale, that are not static. We piloted our distance learning programming, you know, back in, gosh, March, April, May, the fourth quarter of last year. We started our programming because that's when everything moved online out here. And again, we started small. We started simple. We didn't say we're gonna build this huge, you know, massive program and portal and it's going to be perfect. We said, let's just try little things. Let's improve them along the way. Let's ask our parents and our kids for feedback. Let's zoom in together. Let's hack things and just keep a very open mindset about growing and getting better and knowing that this is not going to be perfect at the beginning, but let's just be really responsive, you know, to growing this thing together. And we got such good feedback from our families, you know, at the end of the year that we said, okay, we've got a great starting place. This is working. Let's start from here. And let's again, have that mindset that this is always going to be living. It's never going to be finished. And we started the year with that thinking. So I don't want to say it was an easy transition or it's easy to do this. We want kids in the building. We want to be able to do the learning and the styles and the pedagogy, instructional design, psychology that we have, you know, built this charter around. But at the same time, the people that we have just been super flexible and open to, you know, creating learning opportunities that are, you know, nimble enough to be able to do them on a Zoom call or on a Google Doc or in a small, you know, Google Classroom breakout session. So it's been challenging, but it's been interesting to, you know, to be witness to the educators and the instructional leaders who are bringing all of this to life.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, could you give maybe some examples? Because I think a lot of people that I've been talking to, a lot of parents and families, they're talking about being on Zoom calls for hours at a time, 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
This is like second graders and third graders. And I know you have sixth and seventh graders.
Yeah, but that's not how we roll.
Right. And so I think it would be valuable for them just to hear something that's working, because they're banging their head against the wall and they're like, what do we do? How do we work with this? And obviously they're looking at pods, they're looking at homeschooling, they're looking at all these other options. So yeah, I'd love to give them something that's working. So maybe they can go back to their school and give some feedback and say, hey, maybe we can do this.
God bless the parents right now who are taking care of all our kids now. You know, it's funny. I think educators in public schools specifically are going to get a lot more respect after this, after, you know, parents have said, gosh, you got to put up with my kids for 8 hours a day. And, you know, it's tough because kids want to be taught. Kids want to be engaged. They want to be social. They want to work alongside of, you know, alongside of people. It's hard to not entertain, but, you know, keep the attention of an 11-year-old. And I can't even imagine a synchronous class with a second grader all day. I can't even picture that. I have a hard time, and I'm 34 and I'm a school leader. I can't be on the Zoom for more than an hour. We do a blend of asynchronous and synchronous learning. There are different schedules for our sixth and seventh grade. They were made collaboratively with our instructional leaders. They were, you know, they were given out to our families. Families offered feedback. They've been adjusted. Kids offer feedback. They've been adjusted. So to start, we went through a really collaborative, responsive process to allow for people to have a say in what would work for them. Because our 200 families are not the same as the 200 families on Maui or in California or wherever, right? So that was the first thing that we did. And that's been our approach for a lot of the things that we've been doing. The second is that we, like I said, I bring it back to the academics, the leadership development, social emotional 21st century skills. So the way that we're teaching, the way that we're giving learning opportunities to our kids are coming through different modes. You may be working on a math lesson, but then you're going to listen to a song and you're going to highlight the lyrics that you enjoy. Then you're going to draw a picture of those lyrics and how they connect to your life. And then you're going to post them to Unruler, which is like our school's internal Instagram. And then you're going to have to go and drop positive comments on other kids' posts. And then you're going to have a one-on-one coaching call just to get some positive feedback from one of your coaches. And then you'll hop into an advisory for half an hour. And then you'll have a two-hour block to work on Hawaiian studies. And then, you know, it's just this mishmash of different learning opportunities. So the mode changes so much that kids aren't waking up and turning on their computer at 8 and turning it off at 3. And I think that mode change really allows our kids to put different hats on each day. Okay, now I'm a creator. Okay, now I'm a collaborator. Okay, now I'm a listener. Okay, now I'm one-to-one with my coach. It's a little bit more intimate on the Zoom. So I have to actually talk and engage with someone who's here to ask me open-ended questions. You know, there's just different modes day to day that that we've gotten really good feedback around. Now, it's not perfect. We're still working through the qualitative comments that our parents have said, but overall, the comments that have been offered to us are just about increasing technological efficiencies, offering workshops on Zoom and on Google Classroom, and making sure that parents can sift through all the different emails and just supporting from a tech end. But the different modes of learning, I don't know. If someone can show me a really great synchronous all day, 7 hour Zoom session that is working well, I would love to see it. But I know that our kids have to move. They have to be in different modes of learning. They have to be creating and using their different learning styles and you know ideating styles in different ways throughout the day. So yeah, it's been an interesting experience creating the online school, but I think it's been going really well.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And I don't think that 7-hour Zoom synchronous that actually works, I don't think that exists. And so that sounds amazing what you've been able to create at Dreamhouse. That's awesome. So thank you. So yeah, just to wrap up, I'd love to ask kind of one final question and let you dream a little bit. But I'm curious, if you look 10 years down the line at Dreamhouse and what your students are doing, I'm curious, what do you envision the future looking like with everything happening with COVID? It appears to be some sort of college shift happening. I don't know how big it's going to be, but with some of the changes happening at higher ed, what do you see your students doing in 10 years? What do you see Dreamhouse being in 10 years? And also, where do you see yourself being in 10 years in the future and what education looks like?
Yeah, good question. So I'll go student, school, me. So students, you know, when I walk into co-working spaces, my wife is from the Bay Area. So when I was back and forth courting her to come to Hawaii, I would go and work at these co-working spaces and coffee shops. It was always so cool because you walk in and you see some hipsters in the corner drinking coffee, working on a Mac, doing some photography. Then you got some people doing some woodwork and stuff. Then you got some people doing some finance. And there's just these little pods of 3, 4, 5 people working on projects. That is what I see when I see our kids, you know, years from now. That is what I would love to see, this co-working space mentality and environment where kids are working on projects and concepts that cut across curriculum levels. That's not, bring 25 kids, math, bring 25 kids, English. Completely different than that. You know, you'd look behind me and you'd see 4 or 5 kids building a bike, and then kids are taking a picture of it, and then they're uploading and writing a project, and then the bike person is coming in and, you know, talking to them about, you know, that is the future of how kids not only learn, but how kids are going to create and produce. We're not asking someone to come out and be a mathematician or an English professor. We're asking kids to be able to do both at the same time while engaging with people in very different ways. So I just want to make sure that we can look out and see and believe that it's possible to do this and have it still fit in this, you know, public education box that we have created for ourselves, really. So that, I think, is where the students in the school is going to be. For me, I don't know. I have told people that I commit to growing the school to 2026, and after that, there will be a different leader of Dreamhouse. So that is my commitment. Going back to my how leaders in Indigenous communities need to know how to step forward, step back, and step out. I truly believe that. I wrote my dissertation around that idea. That was from one of my professors. I built Dreamhouse, or helped build Dreamhouse, with that idea in mind that it cannot always be me. I cannot always be the leader of the community. There have to be other people involved in leading the school into the future. And that won't be me 10 years from now. If I'm talking to you in 10 years, I'm standing in this place, I've done something wrong, because this school is not just about me. It is about so many other people. It's about our kids, and it's about people taking really strong agency over the direction and the vision and the purpose of our school. So that means there will be different people in leadership. There will be different faces, different ideas taking us into the future. And I can't wait to come back and visit and see what it looks like and feels like in 10 years.
That's awesome. That's amazing. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your time. I think you are a true inspiration in your work, in your mindset. And I think school leaders all over the country can learn a ton from you, and you definitely inspired me just getting to talk to you over this last hour. So I just want to say thank you so much for all the work that you're doing and for taking the time to talk.
Cool. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah, let's definitely keep in touch and let me know if I can help or weigh in on anything. And can't wait to get you out to Hawaii once all this nonsense calms down.
Thank you for listening to the Learning Pod Network. If you'd like more information about our offerings and services, please go to www.impactconnections.org. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at ImpactConnectED. We will also be releasing our weekly newsletter called Teaching Tuesday, every Tuesday, where you'll get a summary of all of our latest information and resources that we have found as we explore the best practices of learning pods and education during COVID-19. So thank you, and we hope you'll join us next week. Take care, be well, and teach together.